So, if you remember last time, maybe you do, maybe you don't, we talked about the church's magisterium, and we said that, of course, it's the Pope and the bishops that are members of the teaching body of the church. And, of course, there is a bit of a problem because, of course, they were the ones that were at the Second Vatican Council, and a lot of things happened at that council, none of them, very few of them, very good. And, of course, the council began under the pontificate of John the 23rd. Okay, so here's the question that's asked. Does Pope John the 23rd have a share in the responsibility for the current crisis? Okay. It says he is the Pope who made the crisis, which had been simmering for decades. Okay, it didn't just start then, but it was under wraps. We talked about the fact that during the reign of Pope St. Pius X, he condemned the modernists. Of course, they went into the woodwork, but they didn't disappear. So despite warning voices, he convoked the Second Vatican Council. Okay, it became the marching order for an unlimited upheaval as well as for the entrance of the spirit of the world into the church. Okay. So it says, now, not only for convoking the council, John the 23rd should be blamed for the goal and the spirit of the convocation. His opening discourse, the council, after recalling that the church had never failed to condemn errors, Pope John the 23rd continued. He says, this is a quotation from Pope John the 23rd. Nowadays, however, the spouse of Christ prefers to make use of the medicine of mercy rather than of severity. She considers that she meets the needs of the present day by demonstrating the validity of her teaching rather than by condemnations. Not certainly that there is a lack of fallacious teaching, opinions, and dangerous concepts to be guarded against and dissipated. But these are so obviously in contrast with the right norm of honesty and have produced such lethal fruits that by now it would seem that men of themselves are inclined to condemn them. Okay. And it goes on to say that the Pope was also against the, quote, prophets of gloom, unquote, and thought that the errors would vanish by themselves like fog before the sun. These problems just don't go away. You know, as we see, we are living through the consequences, they're living through the consequences of these problems. What's blameworthy in these statements? Its naive viewpoint has no connection with reality. Buddhism, Islam, Protestantism are errors that have existed for centuries and have scarcely vanished by themselves. On the contrary, they are spreading even more because the church nowadays refuses to condemn them. In the church itself, despite the optimistic expectations of Pope John the 23rd, the truth has not shone, but on the contrary, a multitude of errors have spread. Okay. So we've got this whole situation where truth is not defended and errors are just propagated. So, Archbishop Lefebvre witnessed an episode while a member of the Council's Preparatory Commission. At one of the meetings in which one of the experts for the Council were, when they were being chosen, he was astonished to discover on the list, contrary to the rules, the names of at least three experts who had been condemned by Rome for their heterodoxy, for their non-Catholicity in what they said. At the end of the meeting, Cardinal Ottaviani approached Archbishop Lefebvre and explained to him that this was at the Pope's express wish. Thus, the Pope, one of the council experts, the integrity of whose faith was questionable.
Are these separate than the four Protestant theologians that were present? This is something else.
I think he's trying to remember some other stuff.
These are ones that are supposedly quote unquote Catholic, but not
right. Yeah. Okay.
So this is within the realm.
So these are like guys who were in hot water.
They were known, but not in a good way.
Right.
Pope Paul VI continued the council after Pope John XXIII's death, clearly supported the liberals. He appointed the four cardinals, Daufner, Suenens, Lercaro, and Agagianen, to be the moderators of the council. The first three were well-known liberals. The fourth was not an outstanding personality. So then they asked the question about Pope Paul VI. Didn't he oppose the liberal bishops, especially during what came to be called the Black Week in November 1964? Because even if Paul VI sometimes acted against the extremist liberals, it is certain that the situation of the conservatives among the Council Fathers was practically blocked because the liberals visibly enjoyed the Pope's favor. So maybe he wasn't, you know, as liberal as what maybe they would have liked, but he certainly wasn't favoring the conservatives. Here's what, in December 7th, 1965, Pope Paul declared to the council. Here's a direct quotation. "The religion of the God who became man has met the religion, for such it is, of man who makes himself God. And what has happened? Was there a clash, a battle, a condemnation? There could have been, but there was none. The old story of the Samaritan has been the model of the spirituality of the council. A feeling of boundless sympathy has permeated the whole of it. The attention of our council has been absorbed by the discovery of human needs, and these needs grow in proportion to the greatness which the Son of the Earth claims for himself. But we call upon those who term themselves modern humanists and who have renounced the transcendent value of the highest realities to give the council credit, at least for one quality, and to recognize our own new type of humanism. We too, in fact, we more than any others, honor mankind." Literally, have the cult of the worship of man. That's Pope Paul VI. So it says, we can look at this in contrast to the advice given by Pope St. Pius X in his first encyclical. Here's a quotation. "We must use every means and exert all our energy to bring about the utter disappearance of the enormous and detestable wickedness so characteristic of our time, the substitution of man for God." Unquote.
This is a quote of the Pope.
That's Pope St. Pius X. Okay. Where it's in direct opposition to everything that was just said by Pope Paul VI. Freemasonry, okay, has the cult of man, but not the Catholic Church. Hearing Pope Paul VI promote the cult of man, the Freemasons must have savored their triumph. Is it not the achievement of the plans they forged in the 19th century? Question mark. They wanted to take over. So the plans of the Freemasons were made known through a secret correspondence of the heads of the Italian Alta Vendita, which fell into the hands of the Vatican police in 1846. Pope Gregory XVI ordered them to be published. And these plans foretell that the Freemasons would do everything so that a pope, according to our wants, could ascend to the throne of Peter. They explained, quote, that pontiff, like the greater part of his contemporaries, will be necessarily imbued with the humanitarian principles which we are about to put into circulation. You will have fished up a revolution in tiara and cope, marching with cross and banner, a revolution which needs only to be spurred on a little to put the four quarters of the world on fire. So here it says, can it really be said that Paul VI was a pope imbued with humanitarian principles? It says, the following hymn which Paul VI intoned when man walked on the moon would be suitably placed on the lips of a Freemason. Quote, hail to man, hail to thought and science, to technology and work, hail to the boldness of man, hail to man, king of the earth, and now prince of the heavens. Unquote.
The Pope?
That's Pope Paul VI. Well, you know, one other thing that, of course, is very much characteristic, and I don't know, maybe I'll see it later, I don't know, but when he came to the United States, he addressed the United Nations. And, of course, I think most of you know, he says, we look for the answers to the world's problems from you. We look to the United Nations for the solution to the problems of man. It says, what else should be pointed out about Paul VI, what should be known about him? It says, it was during his reign that the persecution of priests who wanted to stay Catholic and who refused to abandon the faithful to Protestantism, modernism, and apostasy began. Okay. So it says, what about Pope John Paul II? Okay, Pope John Paul II was a stronger personality. He was firmer on certain points, but he also committed himself more resolutely to the course of novelties. He performed actions to which the note of apostasy or suspect of heresy would formerly have been attached. So here's examples of Pope John Paul II. On the 29th of May in 1982, Pope John Paul II recited the Creed with the so-called Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Runcie, in Canterbury Cathedral. These are Anglicans. Okay? They're valid, their orders are invalid. They're not part of the clergy. Okay? He said, and they gave a benediction with him. The primate of the Anglican Church was vested in all his pontifical regalia, whereas in truth, he is just a layman by reason of the invalidity of the Anglican orders. So there you have Pope John Paul II officiating with him. Okay. Are there any other examples? Maybe it's just, I would see if it's just a one-off situation. Because there's worse. His participation in idolatrous rites. Remember the first commandment. Don't forget about it. Okay, it's the first one for a reason. Okay. So, in August of 1985, Pope John Paul II participated in an animus rite in the sacred forest of Togo. On February 2nd, 1986, at Bombay, he received on his forehead the tilak, which symbolizes the Hindu deity Shiva's third eye. On February 5th, at Madras, he received the Bhuti, sacred ashes, the sign of the doors of Shiva and Vishnu. I'm sorry I'm not so much up on these religions. Okay, I'd rather stick with a true one. How far did the Pope's participation in false worship go? Okay. The side climax of these activities was reached with the prayer meeting of religions at Assisi on October 27th, 1986. The Pope invited all the religions of the world to come and pray for peace at Assisi, with the representatives of each religion praying according to their own rite. Catholic churches were placed at their disposition for the celebration of pagan rites. In San Pietro's church, they even placed a statue of Buddha on the tabernacle. I'm sure you've heard about it. Next question, trying to find something good about it. Isn't it a good thing to promote peace and elicit prayers for this intention? Question mark. It's not peace, but idolatry and superstition that are bad, for they seriously impinge on the honor due to God. A good intention can never justify committing or encouraging inherently bad acts. Okay. Now we go on from there, trying to say maybe that was it. So the question asks, did Pope John Paul II stop there? No. He continued to sponsor annually interreligious meetings like the one at Assisi. He also continued the spectacular gestures in support of false religions. On May 14, 1999, he publicly kissed the Quran. The diffusion of this photograph of this act, widely broadcast in Muslim countries, could only confirm the Mohammedans in their false religion. Then we move on to Pope Benedict the 16th. He is undoubtedly more favorable to liturgical tradition than was John Paul II. On July 7, 2007, his motu proprio Summorum Pontificum, he gave more freedom to the traditional liturgy in spite of opposition of numerous bishops, most notably in France and Germany. On January 24, 2009, he also lifted the excommunications that since 1988 had weighed upon the bishops consecrated by Archbishop Lefebvre, though without acknowledgement that this excommunication had been null. Okay. But though his heart may be traditional, he also received a modernist formation. He was in the council. He was one of those who was involved in the council. In books he wrote as a young theologian, one finds numerous affirmations contrary to the faith, sometimes bordering on heresy. Even if he seems to have changed his mind on certain points, he has not disavowed his former errors. His book, Introduction to Christianity, for instance, is still in print, even though it calls in question, among other things, the divinity of Jesus Christ. Benedict XVI absolutely intends to save Vatican II. That's why he's trying to insinuate in its continuity with tradition. We're going to see that this is impossible. Okay. So, we see this, of course. I think this book was written probably before Pope Francis, 2010, yes. So they haven't had a chance to add. There needs to be a little bit of time to add on to that. Yes, because Pope Francis is actually the first pope who went through seminary, everything according to the new rite. Now the next question is asked to try to save a little bit more. It says, has Benedict the 16th done anything as scandalous as Pope John Paul II? It says, the pontificate of Benedict the 16th comes across as more serious than that of his predecessor. Nevertheless, he's already done some things that are incompatible with the Catholic faith. For instance, at Pope John Paul II's funeral mass, 11 days before being elected to the papacy, Cardinal Ratzinger gave communion in the hand to Brother Roger Schultz of Thais, whom he knew to be a Protestant. One might, however, suppose that he was caught off guard, but because this incident was not repeated at his enthronement mass. During the same mass, he spoke of Pope John Paul II as, quote, standing at the window of the Father's house, unquote, thereby indicating that having bypassed purgatory, John Paul II was already in heaven and proceeded to a kind of instantaneous canonization. Of course, the church has him canonized today. In his first papal homily, Benedict XVI promised to pursue the ecumenical dialogue championed by Pope John Paul II. Just 4 months after his election, he visited Cologne, the Cologne Synagogue, okay, implying that the worship rendered there is pleasing to God. This was on August 19, 2005. It was obviously not a matter of private tourism, but rather a highly symbolic public act, which Benedict XVI added on his own initiative to the itinerary of his trip to Germany. On November 30th, 2006, Benedict XVI took off his shoes and put on a pair of white slippers before entering the Blue Mosque in Istanbul. There, after turning toward Mecca, he paused for a few moments of reflection. Once again, his attitude gave the impression that the worship rendered in the mosque was also legitimate and pleasing to God. Now, remember, the Pope was supporting the traditional liturgy, but he runs into a little bit of a problem, and this, as soon as he supported the traditional liturgy and issued his motu proprio, one of the first ones to object was the Jews. It was the Jews who objected because of prayers that were in the ceremonies on Good Friday. It was the solemn prayers. One of the prayers is for the conversion of the Jews. It's interesting that the Jewish people know more about the Catholic liturgy than many Catholics. On February 4th, 2008, Benedict XVI modified the traditional missal by suppressing every mention of the blindness of the Jews in the Good Friday prayer for them. Okay. So the next question that's asked is, why do these popes pass for conservatives? It says, the conciliar popes generally pass for conservatives because they continue to defend certain principles of the natural law that the modern world rejects, and because in doctrinal matters they seek to restrain the more radical of the modernist theologians. One of the things I thought was interesting too, I was talking to someone about, or I was listening to someone about, they make a contrast between previous popes and Pope Francis. Pope Francis is actually, again, different than the preceding popes. Okay, and when the preceding popes were in office, they tried to say, well, maybe there are certain things with regard to doctrine that the popes are a little soft on, but with regard to morals, they're still perfectly sound. That's what the defense tried to say. Okay. However, now with the current pope, not only do we have a problem with doctrine, we also have a problem with morals that he's trying to push. And so those who are trying to defend him based on the fact that the popes are upholding the morals are now finding themselves in trouble because the current pope also wants to soften the stand with regard to morals as well as his stand on doctrine. Okay, so since there's a large confusion of ideas and viewpoints which hold sway even in the Catholic Church, it's sufficient to defend some point of Catholic doctrine to be labeled conservative. The expression no longer signifies very much. Okay. Pope Paul VI, with regard to morals, Pope Paul VI passes for conservative because of the encyclical Humanae Vitae, which reaffirmed the Church's opposition to contraception. This encyclical aroused much hatred against him, and many bishops were more or less openly against it. It was a rather heated time. It says, given the circumstances, wasn't Pope Paul's the sixth promulgation of this encyclical Humanae Vitae rather courageous? This promulgating Humanae Vitae undoubtedly required a certain courage on his part, and certainly proof of the divine assistance afforded the Church, even in the midst of the current crisis. But it should not be forgotten that Pope Paul VI was chiefly responsible for the prevailing circumstances, since he had refused to follow a clear condemnation of contraception by the Council. The door would not have been so difficult to shut had it not been left ajar during the Council. Of course, the other thing is that other things that were always held to be fixed are being changed. So if those things are being changed, why not this? You know. So they consider that also. So they say, isn't John Paul II a great herald of Christian morality to the modern world? says John Paul II is decried as a hardcore conservative because of his clear position on the question of conjugal morality and celibacy. Yet let us not deceive ourselves. Even in these matters, there has been some doctrinal slackening. Okay, ask for an example. The Pope's declaration gives the impression that if artificial birth control is indeed forbidden, the natural regulation of birth is authorized without restriction. That's according to the idea of John Paul II. But according to Catholic teaching, it is only authorized under certain conditions. When, whether temporarily or permanently, a couple can no longer have children for grave reasons. So he's softening that. For instance, you will find that in many modern churches, Catholic churches, that they will say that natural family planning is the solution to contraception, artificial contraception. It's such that it can't be employed except in extreme matters. And they need to, the couple needs to consult with the priest in order to see, and oftentimes it's consultation with the priest, the doctor, and then the married couple. All three have to come to an agreement of all this. So it's not just as if that's an alternative that's open to all. It's not. It's not. Okay. It says, does the moral teaching of John Paul II deviate from tradition on other points? In the justifications John Paul II gives for Christian morals, the accent is shifted. The dignity of man is always given as the primary reason. The New Catechism of the Catholic Church, for instance, affirms the murder of a human being is gravely contrary to the dignity of the person and the holiness of the Creator. The dignity of the human person is held in high esteem, and that's part of the Second Vatican Council. You know, they talk about the idea, too, of the fact that man has a free will as being the dignity of the human person. Is his why it's so important, because he has a free will. A free will is a faculty of man. He has a free will. A faculty, by its very nature, is indifferent. It's neither good nor bad. It depends how the faculty is used. Okay. Man's true dignity is found in the fact that he's capable of, or has, sanctifying grace, the life of God in his soul. That's the reason why there is a certain dignity in man. It's what raises him above the brute creatures. Okay. He may have faculties that are superior to a brute creature, but it's not just because he has those faculties, because they can be used for his detriment as well. It's the fact that he's capable of, or he's had sanctifying grace in his soul, that's his claim to fame, which is not due to him, but it's due to God. Okay, he says, the murder of a human person is gravely gravely sinful because it's contrary to the dignity of the human person and the holiness of the Creator. Such an inversion of the order of those two things shows just how far the humanism of churchmen has gone. It echoes Paul's the sixth affirmation that the church also has, quote, the cult of man. Now, it says, as it regards doctrine, didn't Paul VI defend traditional doctrine in his credo of the people of God, as did Paul II in his apostolic letter, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis of May 22, 1994, clearly declaring that the ordination of women is absolutely out of the question? It says, the current popes are not, and thank God they cannot be, deficient in everything. But it's enough for them to be deficient in some things for the consequences to be tragic for the whole church. And in fact, these popes have in numerous cases upheld the modernists and abandoned or even condemned the defenders of the Catholic truth. Okay. So he brings up the idea of the condemnation of the ordination of women, which was done by Pope John Paul II. That still is the case. However, with the current pope, he has said that it's perfectly fine on Holy Thursday for the mandatum, the washing of the feet, to have women there having their feet washed because they are part of the people of God. Okay. He says, examples be cited which John Paul II supported the modernists? John Paul II named four cardinals as neo-modernist leaders. The French theologian Henri de Lubac and Yves Kunger, and the German language theologians Balthasar and Casper. Okay. And just recently, of course, Casper, some of the more recent things about him are interesting, because last year, with regard to the Synod of the Family, the Synod was opened, and it was Cardinal Casper, who wanted to encourage the idea of having people who were married, divorced, and remarried outside the church, would have them admitted to the sacraments. After maybe some period of penance, and also after it being approved by the priest or the local bishop to be able to be admitted to the sacraments. In a certain way, that undoes completely the need for an annulment. Why get an annulment? There's nothing you can't do. Why should you worry about an annulment? It was interesting then in an interview he had, I think it was with someone from EWTN, he was being interviewed, and they asked him if the Pope was supporting this, because there was some indication the Pope was supporting this move. Casper was very careful to say that the Pope was not in favor of this. He was not in favor of the change. But what the Pope asked Cardinal Casper to do was to open the debate. Now, sadly, this whole thing is such that it's a moral issue. It's not a disciplinary issue. And so, since it's a moral issue, the question is, can you give sacraments to someone who is a public sinner, who's in the state of sin? It's a public sinner. And formerly, it was always said, no, you cannot. It would be a sacrilege, and you would knowingly give the sacraments to someone who is in the state of sin because it's a public sin. But now we open this up, quote-unquote, to debate. It's, in truth, not really anything that's even subject to debate. And this Pope, who has said, I would like it to be open to debate, but on the other hand, he claims that he's not for it. It's a very fine distinction, to say the least. Okay. Now, who is Henri de Lubac? He's a Jesuit. He lived from 1896 to 1991. He was the principal leader in France of what's called the New Theology. After World War II, the New Theology adopted by the modernist thesis was condemned by St. Pius X in 1907. Okay. It says it confounded the natural and supernatural, doctrinal evolutionism, etc. The Teilhard de Chardin, who lived from 1881 to 1955, said of St. Augustine, don't mention that unfortunate man. He spoiled everything by introducing the supernatural. His confrere and friend, Lubac, who always defended him, not hesitating to abridge his correspondence while claiming to publish it in its entirety, was much more subtle. He admitted in principle the distinction between natural and supernatural, but then in his books deliberately worked to make it lose all meaning. Without denying anything so too categorically, the New Theology excels at making everything hazy by systematically putting forward the least precise authors. It invokes the fathers of the Church against St. Thomas, the Greek fathers against the Latin fathers, and even when useful, St. Thomas himself against his most exact commentators. Pope Pius XII condemned the principal thesis of the new theology in the encyclical Humani Generis in 1950, but the encyclical was hardly obeyed. De Lubac, who had been suspended from teaching by his Roman superiors, was a theologian at the Second Vatican Council and named cardinal by John Paul II in February of 1983. Okay, who is Yerez Congar? Congar was a Dominican. He was born in 1904, died in 1995. He was the father of the new ecclesiology, that is, the new way of conceiving the church. Okay. He's a disciple of Father Marie Dominique Chenu, and he took classes at the Protestant faculty of Strasbourg. Okay. Just after being ordained to the priesthood, he decided to consecrate his whole life to the rapprochement of the church with the heretics and schismatics, going so far as to claim, quote, "Luther is one of the greatest religious geniuses of all history. In this regard, I put him on the same level as St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, or Pascal. In a certain way, he is even greater. He entirely rethought Christianity. I studied Luther a lot. Scarcely a month goes by without my revisiting his writings." Moving right along.
Sorry, I can't.
Subject to strict surveillance after 1947, he would say later, "From the beginning of 1947 until the end of 1956, I experienced nothing but an uninterrupted series of denunciations, warnings, restrictive or discriminatory measures, and mistrustful interventions." He cleaved to the same idea in his intimate diary. He relates that twice while at Rome, he went... I won't say that... This is Congar. He's the one who is Dominican, who hailed Luther as being a great great theologian. That's what he did. Okay. Twice in Rome he did that. Nevertheless, Congar was summoned as an expert at Vatican II by John the 23rd. And it was greatly influenced the council. John Paul II named him cardinal in October of 1994.
These same people were condemned by Pius XII.
He died in 95. He died one later. Make sure you say with mild. Okay, who's Balthazar? He's not, no connection with the king. In keeping with the new theology, Hans Urs von Balthasar, who is Swiss, he was born in 1905, died in 1988, devoted himself to reconstructing theology around modern philosophers and poets. Highly influenced by the fake mystic Adrian von Speer, he also developed the thesis of an empty hell. Named cardinal by John Paul II in 1988, his sudden death prevented him from receiving the cardinal's hat.
Thank you, God.
Who is Casper? He's still around. God still has some work to do.
Yes, he's one of the worst.
What's horrible is I always think, friendly ghost, and he's after all those movies about Casper the friendly ghost.
He was president since 2001 of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Walter Casper is, notwithstanding a declared enemy of the Catholic faith, He says, in his book, Jesus the Christ, he openly denies many miracles recounted in the Gospels. Quote, "We must count as legendary many of the stories of miracles contained in the Gospels. In these legends, one must seek not so much their historical content as their theological aim," unquote. He doubts the historicity of the resurrection. Quote, "This observation of the existence of an historical core in the accounts concerning the tomb in no way implies a proof in favor of the resurrection," unquote. He also goes so far as to put in doubt our Lord's divinity, writing pages and pages to relativize all the scriptural passages that mention it. Nevertheless, Caspar was named cardinal by Pope John Paul II in 2001 without having retracted any of his theses. Question. Does Benedict XVI also back these modern theologians? On September 24, 2005, Benedict XVI received in a private audience for several hours the heretical theologian Hans Küng, whom John Paul II had always refused to receive because of his revolt against the Church's magisterium. On October 2005, he praised Hans Urs von Balthasar at a conference honoring this modernist theologian. In May 2007, he authorized the International Theological Commission to publish a document calling in question the Church's doctrine on purgatory. Hasn't Benedict XVI been trying to appoint conservative bishops? So several of the appointments of Benedict XVI have been disastrous. First one mentioned was Archbishop Lavada. He was appointed prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in May 2005. He used to cover up homosexual priests in his successive dioceses in the United States. He was one of the most ecumenical prelates of that country. He was the first American bishop to visit a synagogue, and he hosted events in his cathedral in the spirit of Assisi, in which Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, etc. participated. He also declared that transubstantiation is a long and difficult word that we no longer use. Monsignor George Niederauer, named Archbishop of San Francisco, is an open friend of homosexuals. He was publicly praised for this by Sam Sinnott and Francis De Bernardo, presidents of the homosexual groups. Monsignor Odilo Pedro Scherer, named Archbishop of Sao Paulo on March 21st, 2007, was previously the Secretary General of the very progressive Brazilian Episcopal Conference. Anyway, so here we are. We have these wonderful things. The next question is, are the post-conciliar popes then heretics? Okay. So they may have heretical beliefs, but of course, they are not like Luther as far as being a condemned heretic. Again, there's a distinction to be understood. It says Pope Paul VI, John Paul II, have done and said many things that are seriously harmed the church and the faith and could have been confirmed heretics in their way of acting, but cannot be proven that they knowingly and willingly denied a dogma. Rather, they must be counted among the number of liberal Catholics who, on the one hand, want to remain Catholics, but on the other, desire to please the world and do everything to accommodate it. It is what is actually, technically, someone who is a liberal. A liberal tries to somehow have it so that you have truth and error can somehow coexist together without contradicting one another. Okay. And their intellects are so, like, for instance, Benedict XVI, for instance. I mean, he's got a powerhouse that's superior to any of us in this room, even all of us combined. And he is so intelligent that he can take things that are contradictory and somehow make it so that they can work together without being such that they clash, that one comes against the other. Strange indeed. So, you know, liberal with regard to the speculative realm, you just can't take truth and error and make the two so that they can work without clashing. And also, in the moral level, they can take what's good and bad, morally good and morally bad, and somehow make it so that they also can coincide. That's why, for instance, it's interesting that when St. Pius X came to the throne, one of the things that he pushed very hard was Thomistic philosophy, because that doesn't work with Thomistic philosophy. It doesn't work. And so, you know, that's why, of course, Thomistic theology has been pushed aside in favor of modern philosophies. Okay. We are at that time that I am going to have to open up to questions, because I think it's about 8:30 now, isn't it?
8:35.
Yeah. Okay. I got 5 minutes for questions. Yes.
Just listening to you, Father, it's interesting. One of the messages of Our Lady at Fatima was, I believe through Sister Lucy, that diabolical disorientation would sweep through the highest places, including the Vatican, and all of these people that you have named, certainly they were picked right off the bat. I mean, suffering from such grave diabolical disorientation. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but Benedict falls in there just as well.
Well, he's praised by some because, of course, he has something more than the others. But it's a relative thing. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those who was involved heavily in the council. In his defense, I was told that his background is very Catholic. His upbringing is very Catholic. But it has to do with his education, where the problem occurred. The modern seminaries were a horrible thing.
Did he ever, do you think, I mean, I heard maybe he saw the way the church was going, and that's why he, resigned or whatever?
I'm not sure.
Did he ever change since the books? Or?
Anything is possible while this person is living.
Right.
Anything's possible. I mean, but will they? I don't know. Pius IX was one who started out with a little bit more of a liberal bent, Pope Pius IX. And then when he started to realize what was all going on, then he took a turn and he ended up being very good. But he got his fingers burnt and he had to change his ways. So it wasn't, you know, so we see that. So, you know, it's not to say it's impossible, but, you know, there's all the other side of the coin says, as the tree bends, so it falls. You know, so there's, you have that going too. So anything's possible.
He never got better from when the book was read. He got more liberal. It was remained pretty liberal.
There are certain liberal tendencies in him. I mean, for instance, he still maintained the tenets of the Second Vatican Council, because if you remember, even recently, when there were some negotiations between himself and the Society of St. Pius X, there was this question, would we have to accept the Second Vatican Council? Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was written in his own hands, we would have to accept everything from the Second Vatican Council to be readmitted in full, in what they term full communion, mm-hmm. with the rest of the church. So that was still his mindset at that point in time. And that wasn't that long ago. Yes.
Wasn't it Cardinal Ratzinger / Benedict XVI who believed in the circle technique for Christianity? The Catholics being in the center?
I don't know. It's possible. It's possible. But see, some people would like to see us back in the still with everybody else because we become a counterbalance. As if somehow we, it's not a question of truth, it's a question of this way we'll balance off the far left.
Help rationalize the next progressive step. Mm-hmm.
That's the idea of modernism. What is it? Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Those are the three steps.
So you kind of wonder why he resigned. You know what I mean? That's how I've always wondered that.
I don't know why. I don't have any special links to him, you know. So I don't really know why. But, you know, there's a variety of possibilities. We don't know. We don't know. But that's this the kind of situation we live in. God is either he wills it or he at least permits it for a reason, and he'll draw out a greater good out of it. So we have to know that. And, you know, it is such that it's still the liberal position which explains why the popes are where they're at. They can somehow be able to accommodate both in their ideologies. It doesn't cease to make them pope, you know, which is the set of a conscious position, but it's just that they're a liberal pope. You know, in fact, if you go through back to the history of the council itself, Pope Paul VI, when he would see that when his advisors would tell him, if you sign this, there are things in that document that are heretical. So he would make such changes in the document to try to twist it back so that it would not be heretical, and then he would sign it. Yes?
Actually, I had a two-part question. One, didn't he turn down Cardinal Manini's first Novastoto Mass? Because of the lack of the canon, and then what did Ottoboni hold in the council?
There were about 400 bishops in the council that were conservative bishops, and they all signed when the council they would defend the faith, and they wouldn't go with these modern ideas, et cetera, et cetera.
About 10% of the bishops, right?
Yeah, it was about 400, I think, is what it was.
Right, so that's about 10%.
But then they kind of just diminished. Now, there were certain things in the original. It was actually in the Novus Ordo Missae. There were certain things that were changed by Paul VI. But in fact, if I remember right, it was in the instructions where there were certain things, and they changed them so that they were more traditional, but the actual text was not altered. So if you don't alter the text, but you only alter the explanation, the text is still there. The explanation was altered, but it still is the same animal. You know, who reads the introduction anyway? Most of the time, people don't read the introduction. They go to read the book. They skip over the introduction. And so, you know, so that's what's happened. That's what happened with the Novus Ordo.
In the book, Open Letter to Confused Catholics, Archbishop Lefebvre talks about that they had written up a schema that they were going to present at the Vatican Council, and he talks about that there were
the original
things,
schema?
The original schema.
Right.
And he talks about that there were things that needed to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
So what were those things that needed to be changed at that time?
Well, there were certain things, I'm sure that, you know, certain adaptations with the fact that you do have to address certain things. Like, for instance, in previous times, you didn't have modern travel the way you have it. You didn't have modern communications the way you have it. You didn't have those kinds of things were not existent in previous times. So you have to address those changes. You can't just say that they don't exist and close your eyes. You have to deal with them. Radio, TV, you know, now we have internet. We have to sit in the conventional dealing with these kinds of things, and you have to be such that you can't just say they don't exist, but you do have to, you know, address them. Issues that have to be addressed because of the things that are going on in the current age. We as priests even have to be updated with regard to how we have to handle these things. They're not very nice problems, and we have to deal with them. So I would say probably there were things that had to be addressed, but they weren't addressed, and they threw it all out, and they put new schemas in their place, following the modernist line.
Okay.
Anyway, I think I gotta go.